under the trees. The horses approved of this, and it got potentially dangerous half-dry grass out of range of the fire, and cut drafts for good measure. Mags cut the turf away to make a fire circle, which he ringed with stones and rigged up a spit. They were tolerably comfortable, except for the minor inconvenience of having to take the horses to water. Unfortunately, the three fighters were no more talkative than the first night, and the four guards seemed to spend their time drinking, working, and sleeping. 3 days later, Perry was finally able to tell his father that there was a trade caravan on the way. 2 wagons, 2 drivers, 4 guards, he reported, having caught sight of it through the eyes of a soaring buzzard. It should get to the inn sometime in the middle of the day. I don't think they'll dare to do anything in front of that many people.
I think you're right, Mags agreed. All right. Do we need to go over the plan again?
Perry shook his head and hurriedly began making up the sort of pack a casual laborer would have. Just a single blanket rolled up, a freeze bag of the sort grain was stored in, converted into a pack, and stuffed with a grass mat he had woven, stuck all over with twigs and leaves. That last was to simulate meager belongings, and for use later. A sling and a pouch of stones on one side of his belt, and a well-worn knife in an equally worn sheath went on the other, and a belt pouch with a few more things in it next to the knife. His father was similarly equipped. Both of them had cut walking staves out of downed and weathered branches. The horses were secured so they wouldn't wander out of the shelter. Laurel was to guard the horses. With Dolan ghosting behind them, they headed out on the road. They would be traveling in the opposite direction from which the caravan was coming. Perry kept track of the caravan's progress through the eyes of the caravaner's horses and of birds overhead, timing their arrival at the inn to come about a candle mark after the caravan, once it was obvious that the guards and drivers intended to stay the night. Perry couldn't tell by his father's unchanging expression of easy affability what he was picking up from the 2 guards on the front gate when they entered. He kept his own expression as dull as possible. A boy in his position, doing casual farm labor with his father, would be footsore, tired, probably not fed all that well, and as a consequence, uninterested in anything except his next meal. This would be just one more inn in a long succession of inns in his lifetime. Though inns would be far fewer than haystacks, barns, and open fields. There was no way they would be able to afford to stay overnight, but they would be hoping there was a meal cheap enough they could afford it, as a change from boiled oats, what they could glean by the wayside, and whatever they'd been able to kill with sling and stone. 2 of the tables inside were already occupied by the guards and the drivers. The girl had already served them with bread, beer, and stew, and she glanced at the 2 of them with an expression as dull as Perry's before shuffling over to them. She was clean, but she obviously worked as hard as the cook and bartender could manage. Bruises on her arms suggested that if she was not actually beaten, she was often picked up off the ground and shaken until her teeth rattled. Perry took his mind off her. He couldn't rescue every ill-treated tavern wench in the world.
"You eatin'?"
she asked.
"Table's only for them as eatin'."
"What you got for 1/2 penny? Mags asked.
"Peas porridge," she replied. "And water."
"Done,"
Mags nodded, and he and Perry sat down at a 3rd table as she went to the kitchen and came back with 2 bowls of peas porridge, almost thick enough to cut, and 2 wooden mugs of water, slapping them down in front of the 2 of them and holding out her hand. Mags dropped 1 penny in it, and she shuffled back into the kitchen. No spoon was offered, but they were prepared for that, taking horn spoons out of their belt pouches, polishing them on the hems of their tunics, and digging in. It wasn't bad, actually. In fact, it was rather good. Whatever else was going on here, the cook was the genuine article. Mags made small talk with the drivers, asking them about the road they had just traversed, and whether there were any farms off it, establishing their personas and cementing in the minds of their listeners that the 2 of them were heading in the direction the caravan had just come from. This was going to be important later. Meanwhile, Mags was asking detailed questions about the couple of farms the drivers had passed. Were they planting or doing an early harvest? Both would mean possible work. Were they hedging or ditching? That meant the same. Perry was surprised and very impressed with his father. For all that Mags had been reluctant about this trip, given that he was, by and large, best in a large city, he'd worked out a persona that was coming across as genuine. All he had to do was keep quiet and look tired. When they had finished eating, they licked their spoons clean, polished them again on their tunics, and stowed them carefully away. Then they drank the last of their water and stood up.
"Not staying?"
called one of the caravan guards. Mag shook his head ruefully.
"Can't. I got the penny. And ain't if we did. We needs to get farther down the road toward work."
"I wouldn't chance the beasts,"
one driver opined. Mags laughed.
"We ain't carrying food a beast will smell. We never camp where we eat if we killed something, and most beasts in summer will avoid a man if they can. Camp away from water, under bushes, you're generally all right."
This elicited some sympathetic murmurs and advice on where to camp. Mags accepted these with every evidence of listening, then bade farewell to the men and left, with Perry following. They headed down the road in the proper direction until they were out of sight of the inn, and then quickly got off the road and took to the trees, getting themselves well under cover and adding to their concealment by enveloping themselves in their grass and leaf mats. From there, they could see the road without being seen. More to the point, Mags could skim the surface thoughts of the men who were likely to pursue them, and hopefully they would learn a lot more than Perry had been able to. For about a quarter candle mark, Perry was afraid their bait had not been taken. The road remained empty of everything but sunlight, dust, and the occasional falling leaf. And then, finally, the three men he had eavesdropped on appeared on horseback, their horses moving at a brisk enough walk to easily overtake a walking man and boy. They said nothing as they passed. They appeared bored. They were probably completely confident they'd soon have Mags and Perry in their grasp. Even if the two tried to run, they'd never escape three men on horseback. Mags and Perry remained in the tree. About a quarter candle mark later, and the riders were back, and this time they looked considerably puzzled.
"They couldn't have gotten that much ahead of us," said one.
"Maybe they went off the road," asked another.
"Why would they do that?"
"How the hell should I know?" the first exploded. "I'm not a bloody mind speaker."
They stopped their horses and quarreled for a bit, the first maintaining it was too much trouble to find their victims, the other two arguing in favor of a more thorough search. The latter two won, and they headed back up the road in the direction they thought their victims had gone.
"We need the dogs," one said, before they got out of earshot. "This ain't the first time we've needed them."
Mags and Perry waited until they were long out of sight, and just when Perry was beginning to think he should see if he could find a bird to track them with, Dallin appeared under their tree. Still wrapped in their camouflage, they scrambled down and Mags leaped onto the companion's back, pulling Perry up behind his saddle. Dallin took off like a shot. He sped deep into the woods as they shed bits of grass and leaves behind them. When Dallin finally slowed, there was nothing much left of their disguises but a few wisps of grass and one leaf stuck behind Mags's right ear. It was uncannily quiet beneath the trees. Only as Dallin slowed to a walk did the sounds of birds and animals return. Perry hoped that the three men looking for them had not been watching for startled birds exploding out of the canopy. That would have been a dead giveaway.
"Did we lose them?"
Mags asked his son. Perry sent his mind searching for birds with the three men in sight. He found a lazily circling buzzard for whom the antics of the three riders below him were enough to distract him from the hunt for food. The three of them had stopped in the middle of the road and were shouting angrily at each other. They were making threatening gestures at each other and back down the road, as if they couldn't agree on what to do next.
"Yes,"
he said, pulling his mind back.
"They're fairly well baffled."
Mags let out a huge sigh of relief.
"That's good. Because it's pretty much what we were afraid of. This inn is a honey trap. They're careful not to take anyone who will be missed, but no matter who it was that built it originally, kidnapping the unwary is the only reason it exists now. If we said we'd wanted to stay the night, they'd have given us a price we couldn't afford for the sleeping room. Then when we hemmed and hawed, they'd have pretended to take pity on us and charged us a pittance for a place on the hearth in the common room. The cook would slip out, offer us some bread and butter and tea, as if she felt sorry for us, and to keep us from suspecting anything, she'd offer the same to the caravanners. The tea would have sleeping herbs in it. Once the caravanners went upstairs, and as soon as they and we had fallen asleep, they'd have trussed us up and carried us off."
Perry nodded solemnly. "And if the caravanners asked about us in the morning, they'd say we'd left at first light. They'd get a late start, 'cause of the tea."
And they wouldn't think twice about it, since nothing would have happened to them. Well, since I made it obvious that we weren't going to stay, the mercenaries had to come after us.
His voice turned grim. All the mercenaries know is that their boss has a fortified place up north of here, and he needs a lot of labor. And it's not just labor they want. It's women for breeding as well. The mercenaries haven't managed to get him more than one or two, but he paid them extra well when they brought one.
Do you know why? I mean, why they want people? Is it a mine like you thought?
Perry asked. Mag shook his head.
They don't know. They only know that they deliver their prey to that walled enclave north of here, and that all they ever see is other guards, never any of the people they delivered. It's a pretty unwelcoming place, more like a prison than anything else. And in the back of their minds was the thought that they've known men who asked too many questions, and those men mysteriously disappeared.
At this point, Dallin had brought them to their camp. They slipped off his back and squirmed their way into cover.
We should stay here until tomorrow, just in case they start hunting in this direction, his father continued. Then, in the morning, we'll pack up and get out of here. With any luck, we'll be home in 6 or 10 days once we reach Withern.
Perry, who had been expecting his father to be concocting a plan to do something about this situation, sat down rather hard and stared at him.
But why are we leaving?
He stammered.
We know they've kidnapped the people that are missing. We should be doing something about that.
Because this is not Valdemar Perry,
his father said with heavy patience, as if he was forced to explain something to a toddler.
We can't just call in the guard. Even the king can't do that. We're outside the border. Realistically speaking, and even though whoever is behind this is obviously kidnapping people, he may well be what passes for the authority here. Crossing the border with the guard would certainly trigger a local altercation and might well start a small war. And even though I technically have the power to notify the guard that people are being kidnapped from this inn, I'd need a lot better reason than what we have now to get them involved.
But some of those people that were taken were probably from Valdemar,
Perry exclaimed in dismay.
Mag shook his head. It doesn't matter. We have to get where I'm within range of relay mind speaking, report to the king and get orders. And truth to tell, Perry, what he is probably going to do is order us to come home and he'll close the road at the border so no one from Valdemar is caught in this trap again.
Perry felt objections building up inside him until he wanted to explode with them. But one look at his father told him that nothing he said was going to make any difference. He subsided into sullen silence. Perry had gone into the sulks again. Mags tried not to sigh visibly, but he was exasperated.
This is what I get for bringing a child along,
he thought, then suppressed the thought. Perry had been incredibly useful and had acted with much more maturity than a mere 13-year-old would normally show. The Kairi, who never would have joined them if Perry hadn't been with him, had also been incredibly useful, and he could understand why Perry was angry. The boy was still young enough to think that it was their duty to rush in and rescue the people who'd been taken, and he had probably been plotting all sorts of clever ways that they could find out exactly what sort of forces they were up against and how they could rescue the people being held. Except that was exactly what they couldn't do, for all the reasons he'd told his son and many more. Technically, they were not even supposed to be here. The only reason they were not already in trouble was because they hadn't actually run into anyone or anything in official authority on this side of the border.
I doubt there is anything like a local lord here, Dallin observed doubtfully.
That just means that whoever this is could probably make the case that he is the authority here, and he could make up some law about conscripting people, and there is not a damn thing we could do about it except protest. Actually, the only way I could make a formal protest would be if I got my uniform and came back in my persona as a herald.
Dallin bobbed his head. True. And there are only the four of us. If we ventured anywhere near this place to investigate, we would almost certainly be discovered and possibly captured.
I have no good way of explaining this to Perry. He's still young enough to be idealistic. We are responsible for the safety of Valdemarans, of innocents. We can't just wash our hands of them and walk away. And yet, we have to. And all I can tell him is because I say so, which is not how he was raised.
He was as exasperated with himself as he was with Perry. But Perry, although he was sulking, was at least making himself useful, cleaning up the horse droppings with the crude shovel they'd made, and taking them out to scatter randomly outside the grove. Perry might be sulking, but he wasn't stupid. He had Laurel with him, and he was probably keeping an eye out for those mercenaries via the local wild birds as well as relying on Laurel's keen senses. Mags waited until he was done, then asked with meticulous politeness,
"Perry, would you check the snares? You and Laurel will be safer doing so than I will."
"Yes, father," came the answer, still sullen, but perhaps with a note of conciliation that Mags had admitted there was something Perry could do that he could not.
"I'll try again over supper," Mags decided, "once he's cooled down a little. He's anything but stupid. I just have to get him to understand how complicated this situation is."
Though how he was going to manage that, Mags had no idea.
11.
"You're going to try and find this prison, aren't you?"
Laurel asked matter-of-factly. Perry finished gutting the rabbit he had found in the snare, then carefully wound up the snare. He strung the rabbit's hind feet on a willow switch with the first rabbit he'd found and moved on to the next snare before he answered. Was Laurel actually on his side? Only one way to find out.
"Yes, I am. We need to know what's going on. These people are right on our border. They have a fortress, and they're kidnapping people, and we don't know why. Even if we can't rescue them, we should at least find out why these dangerous people are doing this."
This all seemed so clear to him. He couldn't understand why his father couldn't understand how important it was. Laurel didn't say anything until they got to the next snare, which was empty, and Perry had collected it.
"Actually, I agree with you," he said. "There was nothing like this group of people when the Hawk brothers were still here, or my pack would have known about them. They sound dangerous. I think you are right to want to find out what they're doing."
Now it was Perry's turn to be silent as they made their way to the last snare in the line, although now his anger with his father was tempered with excitement. Laurel was on his side. Was it possible that Laurel would help him convince his father? If the Kyrie would, there might be a chance he could at least make his father see reason. Another rabbit dealt with, and they both paused.
"We should make sure the mercenaries are nowhere about,"
he whispered, and Laurel gave a brief nod and raised his nose to sniff the air. Perry decided to check first with the inn cat. If the mercenaries had gone back to the inn, as he hoped, she would certainly be in a position to know. And as soon as he touched her mind, he knew he'd been right. She was crouched in the kitchen, ears flattened against her head, listening to the three mercenaries in the common room shout at each other. In her experience, people shouting meant things being thrown at her eventually. He soothed her and pointed out a good place to hide. She dashed across the kitchen to tuck herself in behind a broom and bucket, then relaxed so he could listen. At this point, the shouting had devolved into recriminations as to which of them was the most to blame for their prey escaping. It sounded as if they were going to be at it for quite a while, unless the barkeeper had the authority to make them settle down. He opened his eyes to see Laurel regarding him steadily.
"The mercenaries are back at the inn," he said shortly.
"Good. And I have made up my mind that although your father seems to irrationally wish to avoid considering all options, you and I should not be so foolish. I want you to tell your father what you discovered the mercenaries have done. Eat dinner. Go to bed early and close your eyes, and you and I will discuss this further."
He blinked in surprise.
"You mean?"
"I mean, I don't know yet. I think we need to discuss this, you and I, and I think your father is already set on the course he intends to pursue and is going to add nothing to this discussion."
He swallowed hard. He hadn't actually even considered going against his father's wishes. But maybe they should. That might force his father's hand.
"What is it that Lord Jorthan says? Sometimes it's better to make apologies than try to get permission."
"All right," he said finally, and left it at that. With no particular need for stealth, they hurried back to the grove by the quickest way and came on Mags bringing the horses back from watering them.
"They're in the inn and yelling at each other, father," Perry said, before Mags could ask anything. "It sounded as if they'd already decided we've slipped past them."
Mags nodded and handed him Pog's reins.
"We should still be careful. We can wait them out tomorrow, then leave the day after, when we are sure they have given up on finding us.
Perry said nothing, just led Pog around behind Daisy. Laurel took Lily's reins in his mouth, lined up behind Pog, and they all squeezed in along the rock face in single file, leading the horses. Perry handed his father the string of rabbits and the snares and went to sit down on his bed. Mags got to work, spitting the bunnies and setting them up to roast over the coals. It had been getting dark when he had reached the campsite, and by the time the rabbits were done, it was full night. There were just a few patches of starry sky visible through the tree branches overhead, and the only light came from their little fire. The pease porridge was a distant memory by now, and he was starving. When Mags handed him his share of the food, he devoured every shred of his bunny and gnawed the bones bare before tossing them on the coals to burn down. Then, without saying anything to his father, he rolled up in his blankets and put his back to the fire. His father probably thought he was still sulking. Fine, let him. As long as he thought that, he wouldn't suspect that Perry and Laurel were plotting.
All right, he said to Laurel. What are we going to do?
Laurel had lain down so that he could use the Kyrie's chest as a pillow. He felt Laurel's breath puffing gently on the back of his neck before the Kyrie put his head down on his paws.
First, I do not like that this is taking place this close to my pack. It is probably as close to my pack as it is to your border, and this is a bad thing. It threatens both our peoples.
Perry sucked on his lower lip. See, that bothers me, but not as much as the fact that at least some of the people that were kidnapped were from Valdemar. We should be doing something to get them out.
Laurel pondered this for a bit.
If it were Kyrie, I would feel the same. So there are two things. This is too near our territories, and they have already taken some of your pack. A show of force might free them.
Agreed. But Father won't get the guard. And without the guard, there's just us, and that's not enough. He's right that we can't just find this place and order them to let our people go.
Even with the guard, there may not be enough force to accomplish the dual needs of freeing your people and putting these kidnappers on notice.
Laurel corrected.
This is the difficulty. We don't know anything about them, really. All we know is that there is a fortified place. There are mercenaries. There are people being held against their will. That is not much information. There may actually be no real threat, and your father may be right. Closing the border may be enough to prevent further kidnappings and properly intimidate them. Or the leader behind all this may actually have a small army and the threat is imminent. We must get information. The question is, how? I assume that if we find the place, you can gather information with any animals inside.
He thought about that very carefully. It was clear that Laurel considered him to be perfectly capable of doing exactly what he said he could do, so he had better be careful not to say he could do more than he actually could.
If there are animals in the right places, yes. But if this place is as big as a city, I could do a lot of looking and never actually find out much that is useful.
Laurel thought that over, taking images from his mind of Haven and the one or two smaller cities he had been to.
That could present a problem.
He stifled a sigh. He'd actually thought about that, trying to find the place, lurk outside it, find an animal. And now that he was a little calmer, he was sure his father had thought of the same thing, and realized that if this place was too big, they could both lurk outside and use their gifts and discover nothing of any worth.
It could take a really long time.
They both pondered the problem. And that was when something occurred to him.
When they were looking for us, one of the mercenaries said, "We need the dogs," which has to mean that someone has trained dogs there. And I bet the trained dogs are wherever all the important stuff is going on.
He felt his insides clench with excitement.
If we can get where those dogs are, we'll be able to learn a lot, I bet.
I hope you don't think I can simply walk in the front gate and...
Laurel began.
Perry interrupted him. Both of us! I make out I'm a dog boy. You're one of my dogs.
Laurel caught on what he meant immediately, probably from his memories of Lady Dia's kennels.
That can work. You are small, non-threatening, and dog boys are valuable. But how do you prevent them from using you for some other purpose?
I just make out I'm addled. A lot of dog boys and bee boys are. And they won't turn a hair about my being addled, as long as I can do anything with their dogs.
Which you can.
Because the more addled a dog boy is, the more he's supposed to be able to do with the dogs.
Laurel turned these things over in his mind.
I like this plan. This can work. All right, then. We will wait until your father is asleep. Then you will take only what you need and nothing that will give you away, and we will slip away. I can see in the dark well enough for both of us. We will go to the inn, and from there I will find a trail to this place. There will be one. The inn is getting its supplies from somewhere, and it is probably this fortified place. When we find it, we will present ourselves, and on the way in, I can hunt for us and find shelter.
Perry felt his spirits rising again. Finally! They were going to do something about this. They might even be able to rescue the people who had been kidnapped. All right, let me know when Father is asleep.
He was nearly on fire with impatience. It seemed to take forever. The fire had burned down to coals buried in ash before Laurel nosed the back of his neck. Moving as silently as he could, and finding his belongings by feel alone, he rolled up his bedroll and tied it, put on the belt with his knife and sling and other basic gear, and crept past the horses.
If Father wakes up, he won't be able to see in the dark. He won't know I have my gear on. I'll say I need to relieve myself.
He was afraid for a moment that Dallin would wake too, which would have been a problem since Dallin could see in the dark, but the companion slept as soundly as his chosen. Without the need to set a watch thanks to the security of their hiding place, and neither of them suspecting he'd go off on his own, both of them slept as soundly as they would have at Arvel's home in Withern. He and Laurel eeled their way out to find themselves in the moon-drenched forest. With one hand on Laurel's back to guide him, and carefully trying to use Laurel's keener vision to augment the little he could make out, they headed back in the direction of the inn. The journey had a curiously dreamlike feeling about it. The air was sweet, cool, and still, scented mostly with evergreen. Thanks to seeing through Laurel's eyes, he walked as surely as if it were daylight. There were very few active insects calling under the canopy, and the only birds were some distant owls. Whether it was Laurel's formidable presence that kept predators away, he didn't know, but they might have been making their way through a forest in a tail, a woodland in which nothing threatening stirred. He felt tired and energized at the same time, jittery with excitement and yet strangely calm. It took less than a candle mark to get to the inn, which was closed up behind its gates, the two guards walking the perimeter inside. Perry heard their footsteps in the near silence as they paused in the forest just at the boundary of the cleared space. They sounded clumsy and heavy-footed. That reminded him to walk quietly.
Let's look for that trail. I'm sure there will be one.
Laurel put his nose to the ground, and they wove through the trees as they slowly made their way around to the back of the palisade.
I have it,
the Kyrie said, suddenly, his nose still firmly on the ground.
Keep your hand on my back. The scent is strong. Men and a team of horses, and there is no reason for any caravan stopping at the inn to have come back here. This has to be the pack train bringing them their supplies.
Into the darkness they went, with Laurel pushing on deeper and deeper into the forest until Perry was too tired to walk anymore. Actually, he didn't say anything because Laurel was so intent on following the scent, but he began to stumble, regularly, and stifle yawns.
You are weary, Laurel said after the tenth stumble.
He didn't want to lie, but he didn't think he could keep his eyes open anymore.
You need sleep. I am sorry. I was concentrating too hard to notice.
Laurel brought his head up, and then he yawned hugely.
We both need sleep. Stay here. I will find a place to den up.
Then he was standing alone in the dark. He was afraid to sit down, even though his legs ached, because if he did, he was pretty sure he was going to fall asleep right there. He didn't sense anything dangerous out there, but that didn't mean this was a good time to let down his guard. So he stood there, in the dark, trying to stay alert, trying to listen for anything out in the darkness, leaving his mind open to the faint thoughts of all the nocturnal animals out there looking for danger, and catching himself nodding off every few moments with a jerk. At that point, Laurel returned.
Come along,
he heard, just before Laurel slid his head under Perry's hand. It was not as far as he had feared. Laurel had found them a good place to den up, as he said. It was a hollow under a fallen tree filled with dead leaves, as Perry discovered mostly by feel and partly by looking through Laurel's eyes. Perry took off his bedroll and shook out the blankets, putting one over the leaves and wrapping himself up in the others. Once he had made himself comfortable, Laurel placed himself between Perry and the rest of the world. He took a sip of water from his water skin, laid himself down, and was so tired he fell asleep without even thinking about what else he might be sharing that hollow with. When he woke, it was full light, and Laurel had brought something unexpected. Lying between the Kyrie's front paws was a mushroom the size of a small loaf of bread. Perry sat up carefully to avoid hitting his head on the log, and he stared at it for a moment. "Is that safe to eat?" he asked, his mouth watering in spite of himself. He was very, very hungry, and he loved mushrooms, raw or cooked.
"Perfectly," the Kyrie said with confidence. "I've already had one."
Perry stared at him.
"You eat mushrooms?"
"I eat many things besides raw rabbit. I'm not a barbarian."
Perry smothered a laugh and picked up the mushroom with both hands, biting into it. Even raw, it had a very satisfying, meaty flavor to it, and it was very filling.
"We call them meat mushrooms," Laurel told him, as he reminded himself to eat slowly and carefully and not gobble.
His stomach wasn't used to eating this much raw mushroom, and he didn't want it to get persnickety on him.
"So, I am told, do the Hawk brothers."
He took a sip from his water skin and another bite of mushroom. His stomach seemed happy. The only way this meal could be better would have been if he could have sliced this thing and fried the slices in butter.
"I could probably eat these things for a week and not get tired of them."
"Well, they are not as nourishing as real meat, and I would not do that. But you will be all right for a day or two eating only those, if we have to." "I do not think we will have to. I will certainly catch something by this evening."
Perry nodded, and he made sure to eat every crumb. Sadly, he knew from experience, raw mushrooms did not keep well once cut, bitten, or broken into, so there was no point in trying to save any of it for later. He'd be more likely to find unappetizing slime than anything edible. And once his stomach was full, they set off again, at a better pace, now that he could see the ground with his own eyes. There was, in fact, a very faint trail to follow. If he had not had Laurel's guidance, he might have taken it for a game trail. And if he had not had Laurel's guidance, he would never have known how near they were to their goal until he stumbled into one of the perimeter patrols, or they stumbled into him. But Laurel scented them long before they were a danger.
"Stop!"
he heard, and he froze. Laurel's head was up, and his ears flat.
"We need to move under those bushes. There are two men approaching."
They both moved quickly, but as quietly as they could, and wormed their way into the middle of a thicket of bushes, in deep cover. They waited until the two men had passed and were well out of hearing distance before they moved again. From there, they wormed their way, still using the brush, closer and closer to their goal, which not only Laurel but Perry too could smell by the faint scent of wood smoke. They edged carefully through the brush on their bellies until they could see the fortress. Like the inn, there was a wide area cleared of trees and brush between the edge of the forest and the palisade, and from where they were hiding, all he saw was the palisade of logs, not even a hint of whatever lay inside that barrier. The palisade stretched into the forest for as far as he could see from where he was in either direction. This was much bigger than a mere fortress, that much was clear. Bigger than Withern, for sure. There was only one encouraging thing about it. It was walled in by mere logs. If it had been built to withstand any serious attack by humans, it would have walls of stone. It wasn't as if there wasn't plenty of stone hereabouts, after all. And as big as this place was, they should have had plenty of labor to build stone walls.
"That may be why they are kidnapping people, for labor to build their holding into a real fortress."
Perry took a deep breath. It was now or never.
"Any of those patrols around? We don't want to get stopped before we get to the gate."
Laurel raised his head and took in several deep breaths.
"None that I can smell."
"All right then. Do I look properly addled?"
Laurel looked him up and down.
Your clothing is smudged. There is dirt on your forehead and a leaf behind your ear.
Good. Let's go.
He crawled out from under the bushes, stood up, hunched his shoulders and put a blank look on his face, and started marching toward the gate. By the time he got halfway there, he heard the buzz of voices, and looking out from under his hair to the top of the palisade, he saw the heads, shoulders, and arms of a few men up there. They were pointing at him and gesticulating at each other, though they had not accosted him yet. He was within a couple of horse lengths of the gate when it swung slightly open. Two men came out with crossbows pointing at him. He stopped, but said nothing. A third man, unarmed, emerged between the two.
Who are you?
He barked.
How did you find this place?
Dog boy,
Perry said, his hand on Laurel's back.
What do you want?
The man demanded.
Dog boy,
Perry replied, and he wiped his nose on his sleeve. It took nerves of steel to feign that he was not nervous at all. Inside, he was shaking. Now completely nonplussed, the man continued to shout questions at him, all of which Perry answered with,
Dog boy.
Finally, one of the men with a crossbow muttered,
Sergeant, I think he's a real dog boy. We could use him. Hellfire, we could more than use him.
Look at the size of that thing he's got with him,
the other exclaimed. The sergeant sucked on his lower lip.
Dog boy, show me what you can do,
he said finally, slowly and carefully enunciating his words. Perry scratched his head and stared at him a moment, then looked down at Laurel.
Ready?
Born ready.
He made small, meaningless gestures with his right hand. Laurel sat, lay down, got up again, turned right, then left, stood on his hind legs, which made him taller than all three of the guards, dropped back down and crawled on his belly, rolled onto his back, got up again, and as a finale, did a backflip. When Perry looked back up at the three men, their jaws were hanging open.
Dog boy,
he said. The sergeant got his expression back under control.
You're hired.
Now Perry tried a few new words.
Food,
he said, gesturing at himself and Laurel.
Done,
the sergeant said instantly.
Warm bed. Skins.
He shook his tunic, which at this point had certainly seen better days.
Done and done,
the sergeant replied instantly. With a little hesitation, he held out his hand.
Bargain.
Perry looked at his hand for a moment. Then he looked at his own, ostentatiously wiped it on the front of his tunic and shook the sergeant's.
Your dog boy,
he said, breaking into a grin. The two armed men smiled with relief and lowered their weapons. The sergeant motioned to him to go in through the opening in the gate. He did as he was told and gaped at what he found inside. He'd had a few ideas, perhaps some wooden barracks, perhaps a village. This was a city. A city of 2- and 3-story tall wooden buildings, old ones by the look of them, crowded so thickly together that the streets he could see from where he stood were barely wide enough for a single cart, and a cat would have had trouble getting between them. He didn't have much time to stare, however, as the sergeant gestured to him to follow, and he realized, although he was playing addled, he shouldn't play stupid. He followed with Laurel padding right at his side, sniffing.
Most of these buildings are empty, Laurel observed.
What? How can you tell?
He was already coming to the conclusion that this had been a bad idea. His place was a maze. There was no layout. It was as if people had simply built things where there was space and never mind what was logical. Where were the prisoners? How would he get out of here?
No cooking smells. No wood fire smells. No strong human smells, and most of them smell of dust. I don't think whoever is in charge here built this place. I think he found it and moved in.
Right turn, left turn, left turn, right turn. He was already lost.
Well, if they didn't build it, who did? And why did they leave it empty?
There is nothing in my pack history, Laurel admitted. Perhaps a plague?
He almost panicked until he realized that if there was any residue of a plague here, the mercenaries would have caught it already. But he began to feel as if the buildings were all staring at him, populated by a horde of lost spirits.
I cannot smell any spirits, Laurel objected.
Wait, you can smell spirits?
Of course I can. So can dogs and wolves and foxes. Cats see them.
If he hadn't been playing a part, he would have stopped dead in his tracks and stared at Laurel. He couldn't do that, of course, and the sergeant was hurrying through the eerily silent streets, and he had to sprint to keep up. The houses were all built in a single style, and it was one he didn't recognize. The roofs were all made of slate and were a peculiar rounded shape, as if they were imitating the mounded forms of thatch roofs. And there were two odd little vents built into the street-facing sides of the roofs, vents that looked uncannily like half-closed eyes, as if the houses had faces wearing a suspicious expression. It was extremely unsettling. The windows were very tall and narrow. The houses themselves seemed narrow to him, too, as if they were each a single room in width. Why would anyone do that when this town was in the middle of nowhere and there was plenty of space? The street between these houses was cold and damp, as if the sun never shone down here. Perhaps the oddest thing was that although the wood was silvered with age, there was no sign of the buildings being in need of repair. It was as though there was something keeping them from damage, even by the passage of time. All that and the stillness, even if Laurel swore these buildings weren't haunted, it felt as if the buildings themselves had a presence. A strange, not entirely friendly presence, as if the buildings were looking down on them and judging them. No wonder the three mercenaries at the inn had been unnerved by this town. Suddenly they turned a corner, and the street ended at a second barrier, a plank fence this time, made of the same wood as the houses. The fence was twice the height of a man, with a finished lintel at the top and a great square gate. The sun finally penetrated down the street here, and the bronze hardware gleamed in the light. The sergeant shouted something, and the gate swung open in unnerving silence. Perry and Laurel squeezed through and found themselves in a large courtyard. There was one single enormous building in the center of it. Although it was built in the same style as the rest of the buildings in this strange city, it was 4 stories tall, as wide as 30 farm carts placed end to end, and had 2 rows of 2 dozen of those eye-like vents built into the roof. This building looked like a many-eyed giant glaring down into the courtyard with suspicion. The courtyard was paved in slate that matched the roof. There was a staircase leading from the courtyard up to the second floor, with double doors at the top of it. Probably the entrance, Perry decided. Strange that there was no way into the first floor, though. The building, like the ones outside, was silvered wood and gray slate, cold and intimidating. The captain came in through the gate and waved it shut, then made a shooing motion and hurried them around the side and to the back. There, finally, were signs of life. Single-story buildings with flatter gray slate roofs everywhere. Outbuildings with no obvious purpose, stables with horses, and people caring for them. Soldiers moving purposefully from building to building, and finally, there were all sorts of smells, some pleasant, some not, but an overall scent of wood smoke. And there was one particular building with a fenced yard with barking coming from it. Now Perry acted as he thought a real dog boy would, pushing past the sergeant and running to open the door into that building. As soon as he did so, the din was deafening, and the smell of urine and feces was overpowering. Someone was not doing his job. No wonder they needed a dog boy. Lady Dia would have a right fit, he told Laurel.
I do not know who Lady Dia is, Laurel replied, but I believe having a fit would be the appropriate response here.
So Perry looked around, spotted someone who was pretending to work, ran up to him, grabbed him by the front of his filthy tunic, and shook him until his teeth rattled.
Dog boy!
He screamed at the top of his lungs, at the same time issuing a mental shout of,
Shut up!
To every dog in the building. In the silence that ensued, he let go of the man who dropped to his knees, cowering.
Now that's more like it, said the sergeant.
By supper time, no one who had seen the previous state of things within these walls would have recognized the kennel. By dint of searching, Perry had located all four of the people who were supposed to be caring for the dogs. Two had been sleeping in the one clean corner, one had been pushing a broom around the yard, and one had been pretending to clean in a kennel. With Laurel at his side, he quickly intimidated them, although, to tell the truth, it wasn't all that difficult to do so. All four were men who seemed to have real mental deficiencies, and the scars on their skulls suggested reasons why. He discovered that the kennel was at least as well appointed as Lady Dia's, with its own pump and a giant copper for heating water. He set all four of the attendants to a thorough scrubbing of the kennel itself with hot water and brown soap, while he put all the dogs, big, rangy mastiffs, all male, in the yard. Once they were all out there, milling around and whimpering with confusion at the sudden change in their lives, he confronted them. They were already cowed by his initial mental command, and Laurel's presence at his side ensured that they remained cowed. He looked the entire pack of 20 over, sternly, one at a time, until each one dropped to the ground in a submissive pose. "Pack leader," he told them, though actually it was not in words, but in the impression that he was their leader from now on. And it was in a mental tone that would accept no challenge. At this point, having never in their lives had a human's voice in their heads, they were not even thinking of challenging him. He got tail-thumping, submissive assent from all of them immediately. "Pack second," he told them, projecting an image of Laurel into their heads. And to confirm this, Laurel went to each of them, took their necks briefly in his massive jaws, and gave each of them a quick shake. He let them feel his approval, which got more tail thumping, and a couple of the boldest came up to him to lick his hands. "Play quiet," he told them, and he went back to supervise the cleaning of the kennel. When the building was scrubbed so completely you could have eaten off the stone floor, he demanded fresh straw. What he got was heaps and heaps of long pine needles, which he frowned at, but was secretly pleased with. He hadn't actually expected straw. Where would they have gotten it from? But pine needles were a more than acceptable substitute. They'd repel fleas, and the dogs would appreciate the soft nests they could make in them. Each of the dogs had his own stall in the kennel, each equipped with a door so they could be locked in, but he had a notion that he could do with his mind speech what Lady Dia did with training. It had worked so far. Dogs, after all, were social. They did better when they could be with others. When the kennel was clean, each stall had a heap of pine needles, and the water troughs were filled with good clean water. He let the dogs in from the yard and sent his four helpers out to clean the yard as thoroughly as they had cleaned the kennel. Poor men. They might be as addled in reality as he was pretending to be, but at least once shown what they were supposed to do, they worked at it with a will. The dogs surged into the building, and he stopped them with a gesture. "No fight," he said sternly. "No fight ever." He got meek agreement from all of them. Next, he drummed into their heads that there was only one place they were allowed to use as a latrine, and that was the far right corner of the yard, thus essentially housebreaking them. Only then did he let them sort themselves out according to their personalities. As he had expected, the more dominant dogs did not take single stalls for themselves. Instead, they and a friend chose to bed down together, sometimes two friends, which was all a stall could hold. It was the most submissive that bedded down alone, although he expected that to end soon enough when they realized they didn't have to sleep alone. Dogs liked the company of each other. Given a choice, every dog in here would have crowded together into a single nest. That wasn't possible, so they would sort themselves out as best they could, and be the better tempered and easier to handle for not being stressed by loneliness. He had toiled alongside his helpers, while Laurel had kept an eye on the dogs in the yard to prevent play from turning into fighting, so he was just as soaked and filthy as the helpers were when a man who must be the captain by his weapons and dress opened the door into the courtyard to check on his progress, accompanied by another mercenary. "Down!" he shouted, as the dogs nearest the door started to rise from their beds, ready to bark, reinforcing the spoken command with a mental one. Every dog in the kennel flattened himself to the ground.
"Bloody hell," said the captain, standing in the open doorway, his jaw hanging loose.
The person with him looked just as dumbfounded. Perry raised his head proudly, his wet hair down in his eyes. "Dog boy," he announced.
"Damn,"
the captain shook his head.
"Dog boy, if every man around here was as good at his job as you."
He left the sentence unfinished.
"Go with quartermaster. Food, warm bed, new skins."
"Food, warm bed, new skins,"
Perry repeated obediently and looked at the man who had been designated the quartermaster. He was of middling height, looked as though someone had roughed in all his features with a hand axe, and clearly could and probably did double as a fighter. He didn't look all that friendly, but he was obviously impressed with what Perry had gotten done, because his jaw was just as slack with surprise as the captain's. He clamped his jaw shut and nodded at Perry.
"Come with me, dog boy,"
he said in a hoarse voice. Perry followed him to yet another outbuilding, as Laurel remained to keep order among the dogs. This was obviously a storehouse and contained everything a small army would need, including, he noted with interest, weapons. There he was heaped with several good blankets and even a canvas sheet to augment his own bedroll, as well as three sets of canvas tunics and trews, socks and clouts. He was grateful no one had looked too closely at his boots, other than to check that he had footwear. They were rather too good for the persona he was assuming.
"I'll send one of the lads over with your rations, dog boy," said the quartermaster.
Perry nodded vigorously.
"Food soon?"
"Aye, food soon."
The quartermaster seemed to take it for granted that Perry would be able to find his way back and ushered him as far as the door to the building. Perry took the hint and carried his loot back to the kennel. Once there, he changed out of his filthy clothing into a set of the clean and left the dirty stuff to soak in a pail of hot water, adding more pine needles to one of the stalls that the dogs didn't seem to want, making a double bed for himself and Laurel there. This was where he put his few belongings and his spare clothing. About a candle mark later, two men arrived with meat for the dogs in a pair of wheelbarrows, and a third person, a small, skinny, frightened-looking boy, followed them with a pail that he handed to Perry before he scuttled off. The pail smelled like stew, so Perry put it somewhere safe while he fed the dogs. When the men had left with empty barrows, he turned his attention back to the pail, which had three nested pans in it, one on top of the other, holding hard army bread, stew, and something that, on investigation, proved to be a piece of sweet boiled pudding with berries in it. Certainly good food by anyone's standards.
"The meat is good, too. Wild pig, if I am any judge."
Laurel felt contented.
"Also, if I am any judge, that boy was one of the kidnapping victims."
Perry had been concentrating so hard on getting through all of this without slipping up that he had momentarily forgotten their actual aim.
"Damn it," he replied ruefully. "We need to get him aside somehow and find out where the others are."
"We also need to find out just how many fighters there are in this place,"
Laurel reminded him,
"and who is in charge, and what they want."
"And?"
Perry gulped, suddenly realizing with a chill just what he had walked them both into.
"And how in hell we are going to get out of here once we find all that out."
12. Mags woke in the darkness with a lurch and a sickening feeling in his stomach, knowing something was wrong. A split second later, as the sleep fog cleared from his head, he knew exactly what it was. Perry was gone. So was Laurel. There was no sense of them anywhere in this grove. He clamped down on his sudden surge of panic. They might have just left the grove because they needed to attend to nature. But a methodical mental scan of the area quickly disabused him of that idea. He couldn't sense them anywhere, not even the wisp of a presence that Perry still had when he was shielding. They were gone. They had gotten far enough away that even he could not find their mind voices. That must have been what had awakened him, the absence of those familiar mental presences. For the first time in decades, he felt a rush of pure panic, and he cursed himself for the complacence that had let him relax and sleep so deeply that Perry's escape hadn't even registered.
"Dullin!"
he cried, groping for Perry's bed, only to find nothing but pine needles. All Perry's belongings were gone, which only confirmed the worst of his fears. There could be only one reason for that. Mags had refused to try to find where the kidnapped victims were being held, so Perry had gone off to find out for himself. That tore it. Now his panic overwhelmed him. He knew exactly what the fool boy was thinking. He thought his father was betraying his duty, and since Mags wouldn't listen to him, Perry had taken matters into his own hands. He must have slipped away with Laurel as soon as he knew his father and Dallin were completely asleep. And now, he could be anywhere. Mags had no idea what direction he'd gone in, and without Laurel to sniff out the trail, there was no hope of tracking him. His panic ramped up and up until he was about to leap out of bed and go running out into the darkness in a wild search for his son, when he found himself stopped by Dallin, imposing calm on him for a moment. "Stop," the companion ordered. "If we know nothing else, we know he's with Laurel. You know what kind of fighter Laurel can be. Short of a companion, there is no other creature he would be safer with. If he were in trouble, we would know." He took several slow, deep breaths. "Better," said Dallin. "Now you can properly concentrate. I'll help you. Let's see if we can find him together. I know he is not a regular mind speaker that we can talk to at a great distance, but we can still use your gift. There is no point in running off into the darkness when your mind speech will find him if he's anywhere between here and the inn." He lay back down on his bed and slowly let the shields drop from his mind, stretching himself out as far as he could. He sensed the sleeping mercenaries, the cook and the bartender, the serving girl. He picked up the idle, half-drunken thoughts of the two patrolling guards, but either Perry was too far away, or the boy was shielding, or both. Outside the inn, there was nothing but emptiness. "He'd better be shielding," Dallin pointed out. "You drilled that into him until it was second nature from the time his power began to manifest. These are the Pelagirs. This is no place to let your mind be accessible freely, even if all you have is animal mind speech. The only reason he could sense the ravens and the Daihili is because his gift is as strong as his shields." But that jarred loose a realization. Wait, the Daihili owed them. So did the ravens. But he was not going to have any luck contacting the ravens since he didn't have animal mind speech. But he could easily mind speak with the king stag. The Daihili might even be awake, or at least merely dozing, and with Dallin boosting him, he might well be able to reach the stag from here. "That's a good idea. Let's give it a try, Chosen. The more allies we have to help find him, the better off we'll be." He remembered very well what the king stag's mind had felt like, and with Dallin putting extra power behind him, as he did when Mags was mind-speaking at great distances to other heralds, he stretched himself to his limits. It seemed as though he was feeling around in the dark for a disturbingly long time when suddenly he sensed the mind he was looking for, and it was awake.
"Because you were making a great deal of noise, human. What ails you?"
The Daihili was definitely not in a good mood, but Mags plowed ahead anyway, describing what they had found, the argument he'd had with Perry, and that Perry and Laurel had now gone off on their own. He was praying the king stag would understand, seeing as he was a father too. The Daihili's attitude grew less grumpy the more he spoke, which was encouraging. So he finished up with a plaint born of frustration as well as fear.
"And I don't understand why Laurel, of all creatures, is helping him. I thought Laurel was trustworthy."
The Daihili did not immediately reply.
"How old is your fawn?"
Mags didn't see what that had to do with anything, but he answered anyway.
13.
"That explains it."
This was maddening. "Explains what?"
"The Kairi are fully adult at 10.
For a second, Mags wanted to murder the Daihili for being so obtuse. But then he got it. Laurel had gone along with this insanity because by his standards, Perry was an adult and could make reasoned and informed decisions, not emotional ones. Which right now did not help in the least. If anything, it made things worse because Laurel was going to assume Perry was capable of adult reasoning.
"Who is making emotional decisions now?"
the king stag asked rhetorically.
"Calm yourself. I will move the herd as soon as it is light and safe to do so and come to join you. Is there anything else? Something that might get us further aid in finding the pair?"
"We encountered and helped some Bonbird ravens about a day or so on our back trail."
He didn't know what else to say, but he felt the king stag's satisfaction.
"Good. That will be useful. I will find them at dawn. There is absolutely no point in trying to wake a bird until it is light. I will let them know in no uncertain terms that if you helped them, they owe you. They will probably find you short